This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Medical error is the third leading cause of death in America. Miscommunication between medical practitioners themselves and between them and their patients can lead to life-changing outcomes for those patients and their families. Stephen Burrow's experience is a case in point. In 2009, Burrow's mother Judy fell and went in for a routine partial hip replacement at the Aurora West Allis Medical Center. During the following months of painful recovery, she fell again. Then after 8 days in the hospital and a second hip surgery where she lost a significant amount of blood, Judy fell into a coma that resulted in permanent brain damage. Stephen Burrows is a comedian and filmmaker by trade, but he was thrown headfirst into becoming an advocate for his mother. With advice from friends and lawyers, the Burrows family decided to sue Aurora for medical malpractice. Burrows filmed his mother and her pain levels to keep records for the legal trial to come, and that initial filming turned into material for his new documentary, Bleed Out. Stephen Burrows joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of Bleed Out's Wisconsin premiere at the Milwaukee Film Festival this Saturday. He began by explaining why he decided to turn his mother's story into a documentary.
Well, this has been a 10-year process for us. When I started to film in the early days, I was actually told by our medical malpractice attorneys within the first few days that I needed to film her pain and suffering. I needed to make a record of that because no one else was going to do it. And that was, through this whole process, easily one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do in my life is like stick a camera in my mom's face, especially back when we didn't even know if she was going to survive or pull through or coming out of that coma. So I was basically just documenting everything for the record, because we had no idea where this thing was going. And then as I got deeper into this medical industrial complex siege, and I started to find out how difficult it was to get accountability and transparency, and how it was hard to even find an attorney to even take your case, and even the best cases lose 90% of the time, a friend of mine thought that maybe, you know, I should start thinking a little bit bigger and maybe not just make it just about my— I had basically three things: take care of my mother, pursue justice the only way we could was in the court system, and then the backup plan, the plan C, was maybe make a documentary at some point. We were definitely 3 or 4 years into the litigation when I started to see how unbelievably difficult it was going to be. And I started to find out that medical error was the third leading cause of death in America and all these other things that you see in the film that I didn't know anything about. And I thought maybe we might want to open this up a little bit because this personal story seems to be a universal one.
It wasn't until about 6 years after the initial events that the trial actually happened. So in the meantime, you are dealing with your mother's care, insurance companies, medical doctors, back and forth between Aurora, all of these things that people sometimes get thrown into. But I feel like a lot of times, unless it's an acute case such as yours and your mother's, but a lot of people will get those letters in the mail, the things from insurance, and they'll just want to get it paid and over with and toss it aside and move on. So what have you learned from taking a deep dive, and what would you encourage people to do to look a little more closely when it comes to looking at their own medical care? Because I feel like a lot of stuff just slips under the radar.
Right. Well, that used to be me. I didn't know anything about any of this. I didn't know anything about advocating for a person, you know, in the healthcare system. This was kind of, my mom had made me power of attorney if anything ever happened. And we all, when we do those papers, we get the papers together, you know, we go, oh, it just nobody wants to talk about it because who wants to deal with that? But my mom actually did her papers just about 2 years prior to this. And we never thought we'd ever have to become, like, I'd have to become activated power of attorney. And then it hits you. Like, so what are you going to do with the one thing I would tell most people at this point is that, you know, we're all going to get sick. We're all going to have family members who are going to get sick. And we're all going to end up in the hospital at some point where our loved ones are. And what I learned is you need an advocate. You need someone who is your wingman, wingwoman, sidekick. Because when you're sick, you're not thinking straight. and you're scared and you're frightened and you need someone. Like I literally write on my – I have a little list here. I always have my questions and you will get better care regardless of the institution. You're going to get better care if you have someone who is asking the basic questions and there are no stupid questions. You know, this is your life. And occasionally you're going to irk a very busy doctor or nurse because they're probably overwhelmed as well. But it doesn't matter, you know, because it's going to force them to think about what they're doing, how they're doing it. The other thing I learn now that I wish I would have known this. I could have avoided this whole thing is if I would have gotten a second opinion. Like right away for my mom's hip surgery, the first hip surgery. If I just would have gone to just get a nice, clean, and what I've learned is that great doctors and nurses and hospitals, the reason I didn't do it is I didn't want to offend the doctor. I didn't want to make him mad or think I didn't trust him because we trust these caregivers, doctors, and hospitals blindly. I didn't do it. But I look back now and I go, that second opinion, there would have never been – we would have avoided this whole thing. And I would also say that I've learned that you actually – you know, it's tough to want to deal with this stuff. No one wants to, but I'm telling you, your life depends on it. And you got to start shopping. You know, we all shop for houses and cars and clothes, but we're not shopping for, you know, if you need your tonsils out, if you need to have appendix surgery or even a doctor's appointment. Like what doctors, what institutions are specializing in what's going on with you? I think that shopping, it's your life. And 10 years ago, I would have just, whatever.
Yeah, I'll get to it when it reaches a point where
exactly.
I can't stand it.
You can't wait.
Yeah.
Don't wait.
Mm-hmm. Our state legislature has made it more difficult for patients to fight against hospital negligence. So what is Wisconsin's place in this? And is it unique or is it just one example of a nationwide trend?
It's my understanding that the national trend is not good with this, patient safety. Every state has these organizations, and now we've been meeting people, especially the last 3 or 4 months, who are fighting in every one of their states for patient safety and patient rights. And like, can't we all – I mean, isn't this – shouldn't we all be on patient rights? Isn't that something we can all agree on? And there are laws in each state where that are set up that – limit patients' rights. Wisconsin is one of the worst, without any question, one of the harshest. Even some of these laws, like the doctor privilege law or the I'm sorry law or the single person law, those are, even for these hardened pros who've been fighting for patients all these years, those laws shock the old pros. So it's bad here, real bad.
Another aspect to medical care that we all have to deal with is insurance companies. This film also shows just the widespread aspect of that medicine is corporate. It is a business, which in turn makes care impersonal. So do you think we're ultimately living with an inherently broken system if it's based off of business and policies and not about doctor-patient relationships at its core?
Right. Absolutely. In my experience, one should not How do I say this? The size of your wallet should not determine the quality of the healthcare that you get. And I know that I've learned through the vast majority of hospitals and doctors and nurses that we've met through this process is they all want to do the right thing. You know, they want to spend more time with the patient, especially the doctors. That, you know, like an office visit. And a lot of these doctors only can spend 10 to 15 minutes with a patient. And what they want is they want to be able to spend as much time with the patient as they need. And what we found in interviewing like the Mayo Clinic, we went to the Mayo Clinic in the film, and their whole thing is patient safety. The patient is first, not the money. Regardless of their ability to pay, you come into the Mayo Clinic and facilities like that, they look at you and it's all about what can we do for this patient? It's not about how many hip surgeries can we crank out a day. It's what does that one particular person need that day? And it works. But there's this money incentive and, you know, the insurance companies, they win no matter what happens. Whether they pay or not, they're still making money, regardless of the outcome of any patient situation. It's like, who's going to, you know, I keep asking in our film, like, who is in charge of my mom's care? which I still don't know.
10 years later.
10 years later. But who's in charge of healthcare? Like, somebody tell me.
Overall, yeah.
Right. I've been asking some of the brightest minds in patient safety, like, who's in charge of healthcare? And they're like, yeah, good question. That should frighten people. Scares me.
One thing that gave me pause was the whole aspect of telemedicine. So when your mother was moved to an ICU after her second hip surgery, there was a camera essentially watching over her in the corner that was linked to a remote care facility. You know, someone looking through monitors to check on patients versus a physical doctor right there with her post-surgery. And this is the focal point of what caused a lot of declining problems and long-term consequences. I wasn't even aware of telemedicine until this. So is this something that's very widespread, or was it just something that's being launched at several hospitals, or is it something that, again, is part of a system that's too big to fix or fail that is just a reality patients have to live with?
The telemedicine industry, especially this eICU thing, electronic ICU, is spreading like wildfire across the country. And I didn't know anything about it. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I was in the hospital with my mother after she was found in a coma. I actually found her in a coma. I was the person who noticed that something was wrong. She'd been there for 2 days in the ICU. And we found out about it by accident. Nobody at that facility told us anything about this. We wanted to meet with the doctor who was in charge of my mom's care in the ICU that night. And they said there wasn't a doctor there, that there was a camera doctor out by the airport. And that's all we knew. And then we started to investigate. We went through litigation. We found out, at least in our case here in Wisconsin, that this electronic ICU camera, in my mom's case, replaces the bedside doctor in the intensive care unit. Now, there's great reasons to use telemedicine, but it does not replace the bedside doctor. And nobody knows about this. We didn't. And then we found out during our litigation, our trial, that this place, it's out by the airport on the corner of Grange and Howell. And that one facility, we found that there's one doctor every 8 hours watching 15 intensive care units, and they only have, like, I guess, 4 or 5 monitors. And in our case, they told me the camera was never on with my mother. So I'm like, well, I don't understand the point of this. And nobody knows about this. There was one doctor, our surgeon in our case, he claimed he never knew about it. And he was the surgeon. So if the surgeon didn't know, and if I didn't know, and you don't know 10 years later, I don't know what to tell you. That's one of the big reasons why we made this film, was when we found out about this electronic ICU, because I can tell you that critical care doctors across the country do not like this. You cannot.
Not in the most critical time of follow-up.
Yes, exactly. In intensive care, you cannot assess and manage a critical care patient through a camera that's not on.
There's a lot of questions about accountability, transparency. Now that we're 10 years down the road, I'm curious, have you heard anything from Aurora with this documentary?
Well, I have some breaking news for you. You're the first person to actually know this, because we never heard anything from Aurora until about a month and a half after the film came out, which was earlier this year. And I got a letter from the CEO of Aurora, and it was a handwritten letter sent privately. It was not sent, certified or anything like that. And it was not made public. I don't know why they didn't share it with everyone, but it was kind of an apology, not a full-throated apology. They're sorry that, this happened to our family and the American healthcare system. It was a nice letter. They sent thoughts and prayers at the end, and there was no offer of any transparency or accountability. It was just like kind of acknowledging the story, acknowledging the film, and it was nice. So I wrote right back, and I sent it a letter back to the CEO to see if we could. I thanked him for the letter and see if we could meet. to, you know, talk about things. I thought it was the beginning of a dialogue, and we have not heard back. And that's been 6 months.
Are you hopeful that'll also be a call to action for systems like Aurora, for people studying medicine, for people already employed in medicine?
Yes. One of the best things that's happened through this disaster has been, you know, when the film came out, we were so fortunate to get the response was just really very encouraging. But then the public got hold of it. You know, HBO and their tentacles of, you know, millions of people then saw this movie. And then we started winning a couple pretty important awards. We won the Los Angeles Press Club for Best Documentary. And then the non-for-profit organizations, healthcare organizations, started getting hold of this thing. The Leapfrog Group, the Patient Safety Movement, the Global Neurosciences Institute. These are like incredible organizations who have been doing this for years, who never had, you know, they have the story, they have the stats, they have the white papers, they have the research, but they've never seen, you know, it's different when you can feel it. I could have told you our story, but when we show it, when you see it, it's different. It's more powerful and it's more urgent. And that's what they're telling me. And then the next step is now universities and medical schools and nursing schools are making this a part of their curriculum to teach their medical students and residents and nursing students, because it's a 10-year kind of epic journey, and this really happened in America, and we all make mistakes. You know, we're all humans, including doctors. Doctors are heroes, but things happen. It's not always negligence either. It's, you know, just sometimes things happen. The question is, when the mistakes are made, what are you going to do? And the best thing that's happened is the film has turned into a call to action. That was not the intention. I just wanted to tell my mom's story. But now it's no longer our movie. It's the patients out there and their families, and the fact that the medical community is embracing this film and using it as a teaching tool is the now my mom's legacy. That's her legacy, that all of her, everything she went through, you know, I'm haunted by her pain and suffering to this day. People ask me if this has been a cathartic experience or it's been a healing experience for me somehow. If I found peace, no, but I can tell you that my mom's story is helping people get better care. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that.
Along those lines, you know, on one hand, you come at this from a filmmaker and having done this for your career before the events with your mom happened. But it's also so emotionally entangling. You know, even before you decided to start making the documentary, you are spending time flying back and forth from LA to Milwaukee, dealing with insurance companies, dealing with hospitals, dealing with care, dealing with worrying about money, about your mom's money that had to go towards this. And now that you're in this stage and it's after this film is done and reaching audiences, how have you tried to continue to take care of yourself on a base level? Because it is hard when you do get wrapped up, deep dive into an acute case that many people, you know, would fathom to try and even begin to understand. So how have you tried to, I mean, it's not really possible to center yourself per se, but to shift your motivations throughout, to feed yourself and to try and keep it going?
Well, I can't lie. It's been tough at times. I think one advantage, I have a few advantages that a lot of these families that we've heard from, you know, over 5,000 other strangers and their families and their stories. And, you know, a lot of people can never do this. 10 years ago, we didn't know how long this was going to go. We didn't know if my mom was going to survive. We didn't know if she was going to be a long-term patient or a short-term patient. We didn't know how damaged she was going to be. So we kind of took it one day at a time, one week at a time. Next thing you know, it's months. Next thing you know, it's years. And it was always take care of mom first, get her day in court, and then maybe we'll do plan C. And then, as you saw, plan C became plan B. And plan A is still take care of mom. But if I wasn't in show business, if I had like a 9-to-5, I could have never done any of this. If I didn't have a wife who was 100% supportive of this, because you keep saying deep dive, it's like, yeah. I mean, I kind of, I would say to my wife every once in a while, am I like kind of like Ted Kaczynski now? Am I out in the woods in a cabin going crazy? This thing has obsessed me. There's no doubt about it. And I'm only coming out of, I would say the one really good thing about the film is because the film is now done. You know, our lawsuit is done. Our film is done. So there is like the dust has settled and I do see light, and mostly from these medical institutions who are using the film, I see real hope. And that's helping heal me a little bit. But I have not, I can't say, I mean, without my wife, without my family and friends, and without my aunt who really was a big believer in this, couldn't have done it. So, but I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that before. I'm not sure. I just keep going. I don't look back. Maybe I do look back. I'm looking back and in the present and in the future. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, continue whatever you're doing, because this film is very impactful. And I know its reach will go far beyond the screening here at the festival as well. And Steve Burrows, I want to thank you for your work, for the work you continue to do.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here. It's a real privilege. Thank you.
Wisconsin native Steve Burrows is a writer, actor, and director. His latest documentary, Bleed Out, is making its big screen debut at the Milwaukee Film Festival this Saturday at the Oriental Theater. There'll be a panel to follow. And for more information on the film and on medical error in the United States, you can go to wuwm.com.